but it was enough. Further along the coast, on the downs above the small Sussex port of Newhaven, another man gazed at the tossing waves of the English Channel. He was dressed in black motorcycle leathers, his helmet on the seat of his parked BMW motorcycle. A few Sunday strollers with their children walked across the downs, but they took no notice of him. He was watching the approach of a ferry well over the horizon and beating her way towards the shelter of the harbour mole. The convoy would arrive from Dieppe in 30 minutes. Somewhere on board should be Courier 5. In fact, Courier 5 was on the foredeck, watching the approach of the English coast. He was one of those who had no car, but his ticket was for the boat train right through to London. Anton Zielewski, his passport said, and it was perfectly accurate. A West German passport, the immigration officer noted, but there was nothing odd in that. Hundreds of thousands of West Germans have Polish-sounding names. He was passed through. Customs examined his suitcase and his bag with the duty-free allowance bought on board the ship. His bottle of gin and his 25 cigars in an unopened box were within the permitted limit. The customs officer nodded him through and turned his attention to someone else. Zielewski had indeed bought a box of 25 good cigars in the duty-free shop on the Cornouaille. He had then retired to a lavatory, locked himself in, and eased the identifying duty-free labels off the newly bought box, only to stick those labels on an identical box he had brought with him. The ones from the duty-free shop went overboard to a waiting sea. In the train to London, he sought out the first first-class carriage from the engine, selected the required window seat, and waited. Just before Lewis, the door opened, and a man in black leather stood there. A glance confirmed the compartment was empty, except for the German. "Does this train go straight to London?" he asked, in unaccented English. "I believe it also stops at Lewis," Zielewski replied. The man held out his hand. Zielewski passed him the flat box of cigars. The man stuffed it down his jacket front, zipped up, nodded, and left. When the train started out of Lewis, Zielewski saw the man once again, on the downline platform, going back to Newhaven. Before midnight, the cigars joined the radio, plaster cast, and shoes in Ipswich. Courier 5 had delivered. Chapter 18. Sir Nigel was right. By Thursday, the last day of April, the reams of computer printout showed up no pattern at all of East Bloc citizens from whatever point of departure entering Britain on repeated occasions over the previous 40 days, nor was there a pattern of persons of whatever nationality entering the country from East Bloc countries over the same period. A number of passports containing various irregularities had shown up, but that was par for the course. Each had been checked, its bearer strip-searched, and the answer was still a big zero. 3 passports on the stop list had appeared. 2 were previous deportees seeking re-entry, and 1 was an American underworld figure connected with gambling and narcotics. These 3 were also searched before being put on the next plane out, but there was not an iota of evidence that they had been couriers for Moscow. If they're using West Bloc citizens, or in-place illegals with impeccable documentation as West Bloc citizens, I'll never find them, thought Preston. Sir Nigel had again relied on his long friendship with Sir Bernard Hemmings to secure the cooperation of 5. "I have reason to believe that Centre is going to try to slip an important illegal into the country in the next few weeks," he had said. "The trouble is, Bernard, I don't have an identity, description, or point of entry. Still, any help your contacts at the points of entry could give us would be highly appreciated." Sir Bernard had made the request a 5 operation, and the other arms of the state, customs, immigration, special branch, and docks police, had agreed to keep more than the usual weather eye open, either for a foreigner trying to slip past the controls, or for an odd or unexplainable item being carried in as luggage. The explanation was plausible enough, and not even Brian Harcourt-Smith linked it to the report by John Preston on the polonium disc, still in his pending tray while he considered what to do with it. The camper van arrived on May Day. It had West German registration and arrived on the ferry at Dover from Calais. The owner and driver, whose papers were in perfect order, was Helmut Dorn, and he had with him his wife Lisa and their two small children, Uwe, a flaxen-haired boy of 5, and Brigitte, their 7-year-old daughter. When they passed immigration, the van rolled towards the nothing-to-declare green zone of customs, but one of the waiting officers gestured it to stop. After re-examining the papers, the customs officer asked to see in the back. Herr Dorn complied. The two children were playing in the living area, and stopped when the uniformed customs man entered. He nodded and smiled at them. They giggled. He glanced around the neat and tidy interior, then began to look into the cupboards. If Herr Dorn was nervous, he hid it well. Most of the cupboards contained the usual bric-a-brac of a family on a camping holiday, clothes, cooking utensils, etc. The customs man flicked up the bench seats, beneath which lockers served as extra storage space. One of them was apparently the children's toy locker. It contained 2 dolls, a teddy bear, and a collection of soft rubber balls brightly painted with large gaudy discs in different colours. The little girl, overcoming her shyness, delved into the locker and pulled out one of the dolls. She babbled excitedly at the customs officer in German. He did not understand, but he nodded and smiled. "Very nice, love," he said. Then he turned to Herr Dorn and stepped out of the back door. "Very well, sir. Enjoy your holiday." The camper van rolled with the rest of the column out of the sheds and onto the road towards the town of Dover and the highways towards the rest of Kent and to London.
"Gott sei Dank," breathed Dorn to his wife. "Wir sind durch."
She did the map reading, but it was simple enough. The M20 to London was so clearly marked no one could miss it. Dorn checked his watch several times. He was a bit late, but his orders were under no circumstances to exceed the speed limit. They found the village of Charing, lying to one side of the main road without difficulty, and just to the north of it, the Happy Eater cafeteria on the left. Dorn swung into the car park and stopped. Lisa Dorn took the children out of the rear and into the cafe for a snack. Dorn, according to orders, raised the engine cover and buried his head beneath it. Several seconds later he felt a presence beside him and looked up. A young Englishman in black motorcycle leather stood there. "Having a little trouble?" he asked.
"I think it must be the carburetor," he said.
"No," said the motorcyclist gravely. "I suspect it comes from the distributor. Also, you're late."
"I'm sorry, it was the ferry. Also customs. I have the package in the back."
Inside the van, the motorcyclist produced a canvas bag from his jacket pocket, while Dorn, grunting and straining, lifted one of the children's play balls out of the toy locker. It was only just 5 inches in diameter, but it weighed a mite over 20 kilograms, or 44 pounds. Pure uranium-235 is, after all, twice as heavy as lead. Carrying the canvas bag across the car park to his motorcycle, Valery Pietrovsky had to use his considerable strength to hold the bag one-handed, as though it contained nothing of note. No one noticed him, anyway. Dorn closed his engine cover and joined his family in the cafe. The motorcycle, with its cargo in the box behind the pillion, roared away towards London, the Dartford Tunnel, and Suffolk. Courier 6 had delivered. By the 4th of May, Preston realized he was up a blind alley. It had been nearly 3 weeks, and he still had nothing to show for his ferreting than a single disc of polonium that had fallen into his hands by a pure fluke. He knew it was out of the question to ask for the strip-searching of every visitor entering Britain. All he could do was ask for increased surveillance on all East Bloc citizens coming in, plus an immediate alert to himself in the case of any suspect passport. There was one other last chance. From what the experts in nuclear engineering at Aldermaston had reported, 3 of the items required, even for the most basic nuclear bomb, would have to be extremely heavy. One would be a block of pure uranium-235,
One would be a tamper, cylindrical or globular in shape, made of high tensile hardened steel, 1 inch thick. The third would be a steel tube, also high tensile and hardened, also of 1 inch thick metal, about 18 inches long and weighing 30 pounds. He estimated that three at least would have to be brought into the country in vehicles, and asked for an intensification of searches of foreign vehicles with an eye on cargoes resembling a ball, a globe, and a tube of extreme heaviness. He knew the catchment area was vast. There was a constant stream of motorcycles, cars, vans, trucks, and juggernauts flowing in and out of the country every day of the year. The commercial traffic alone, if every truck were stopped and stripped, would almost bring the country to a halt. He was looking for the proverbial needle in the haystack, and he did not even have a magnet. The strain was beginning to tell on George Berenson. His wife had left him and returned to her brother's stately home in Yorkshire. He had completed 12 sessions with a team from the ministry and identified for them every single document he'd ever passed to Jan Marais. He knew he was under surveillance, and that did not help his nerves either. Nor did the daily routine of going to the ministry, fully aware that his permanent undersecretary, Sir Peregrine Jones, knew about his treachery. The final strain upon him was caused by the fact that he still had to pass occasional packages of apparently purloined documents from the ministry to Marais for sending on to Moscow. He had managed to avoid actually meeting Marais since he had learned the South African was a Soviet agent, but he was required to read the material he was passing to Moscow via Marais, just in case Marais called him for a clarification of something already sent. Every time he read the papers he was to transmit, he was impressed by the skill of the forgers. Each document was based on a real paper that had passed across his desk, but with changes so subtle that no individual detail could arouse suspicion. Yet the cumulative effect was to give a quite false impression of Britain's and NATO's strength and preparedness. On Wednesday the 6th of May, he received and read a batch of 7 papers referring to recent decisions, proposals, briefings and queries supposed to have reached his desk over the previous fortnight. All were marked either top secret or cosmic, and one of them caused him to raise his eyebrows. He passed them to the Benotti ice cream parlour that evening and received his coded call of acknowledgement of safe receipt 24 hours later. That Sunday, the 10th of May, in the seclusion of his bedroom at Cherry Hayes Close, Valery Pietrovsky crouched over his powerful portable radio set and listened to the stream of signals in Morse coming over the Moscow radio commercial band he had been allocated. His set was not a transmitter. Moscow would never allow a valuable illegal to endanger himself by transmitting his own messages, not with British and American direction-finding countermeasures as good as they were. What he had was a huge brawn radio, purchasable in any good radio shop, that would pick up almost any channel in the world. Pietrovsky was tense. It had been a month since he had used the Poplar transmitter to alert Moscow that he had lost a courier and his cargo, and to ask for a replacement. Each second evening, and on alternate mornings, whenever he was not out on his motorcycle making collections, he had listened for his reply. So far it had not come. At 10:10 that evening, he heard his own call sign coming over the airwaves. He already had his pad and pencil ready. After a pause, the message began. He jotted down the letters straight from Morse into English, a jumble of indecipherable figures. The Germans, British and Americans, at least, would be jotting down the same letters in their various listening posts. When the transmission ended, he switched off the set, sat at his dressing table, selected the appropriate one-time pad, and began to decipher. He had it in 15 minutes. Firebird 10, replacing 2RVT. It was repeated 3 times. He knew rendezvous T. It was one of the spare rendezvous, to be used only if the occasion demanded, as indeed it now had, and it was in an airport hotel. He preferred wayside cafes or railway stations, but he knew that although he was the kingpin of the operation, there were some couriers who, for professional reasons, only had a few hours in London and could not leave the city.
There was one other problem. They were slotting Courier 10 between the two other meets, and perilously close to the meeting with Courier 7. 10 had to be met at the hour of breakfast in the post house Heathrow. 7 would be waiting in a hotel car park outside Kilchester that same morning at 11. It would mean hard riding. But he could do it. Late in the evening of Tuesday the 12th of May, the lights were still burning in No. 10 Downing Street, office and residence of the British Premier. Mrs. Margaret Thatcher had called a strategy conference of her closest advisers and inner cabinet. The only issue on the agenda was that of the forthcoming general election, to formalise the decision and decide the timing. As usual, she made her own view plain from the outset. She believed she would be right to go for a third administration, even though the Constitution allowed her to govern until June 1988. There were several who at once doubted the wisdom of going to the country so soon, though on previous evidence they doubted they would get very far. When the British Prime Minister had a gut feeling for something, it took some very powerful counter-arguments to dissuade her. On this issue, statistics seemed to support her. The Conservative Party chairman had all the public opinion poll findings at his fingertips. The Liberal Social Democratic Alliance, he pointed out, still seemed to enjoy about 20% of the support of the electorate. That would mean that in Britain, which does not have run-off ballots like the French or proportional representation like the Irish, the winner-take-all method of decision would give the alliance between 15 and 20 seats. Of the 17 from Northern Ireland, 12 would probably go to various types of unionists who would support the Conservatives in Parliament, and 5 to the nationalist factions who would boycott London or vote hard left. That left 613 constituencies, in which the outcome looked like the traditional fight between Conservative and Labour. For a clear majority, Mrs. Thatcher would need 325 of them. The polls further showed, the party chairman intoned, that Labour stood at only 4 percentage points behind the Conservatives. Since June 1983, with its newfound image of unity, moderation and tolerance, the Labour Party had hauled itself back by a full 10 percentage points. The hard left was almost mute, the crazy left repudiated, the manifesto moderated, and the public television appearances by members of the shadow cabinet had for a year been almost wholly confined to the centrist wing. The British public had nigh completely regained its confidence in the Labour Party as an alternative party of government. The chairman pointed out to his solemn colleagues that the Conservative lead was 2 points lower than 6 months earlier, and 1 point lower than 3 months ago. The trend was clear. The same trend was being reported by the party organisation in the constituencies. The economic indicators showed that, while for the moment the economy was buoyant, the weather fine and seasonal factors were cutting the unemployment figure, they could expect public sector strikes in the autumn in pursuit of wage claims. If these were bad, the Conservative popularity could fall suddenly in the winter and stay that way until the spring. There was general agreement by midnight that it had to be the summer of 1987, or not until June 1988. No autumn or early spring elections. In the small hours, the Prime Minister carried her cabinet with her. Only on one point was there heated discussion, the length of the election campaign. In Britain, general elections are by tradition held on a Thursday after a 4-week campaign. It is rare, but not unconstitutional, for a campaign to be cut to 3 weeks. The Prime Minister's instinct was for a 3-week campaign, a snap election, to catch the opposition unprepared and unready. Finally, it was agreed. She would seek an audience with the Queen on Thursday, the 28th of May, and ask for a dissolution of Parliament. In accordance with tradition, she would return to make a public statement from Downing Street immediately afterwards. From that moment, the election campaign would be on. Polling day, Thursday, the 18th of June. While the ministers still slept in the hour before dawn, the big BMW cruised towards London from the northeast. Piotrowski rode out to the Post House Hotel at Heathrow Airport, parked in the car lot, locked the machine, and shut away his crash helmet in the box behind the pillion. He eased off his black leather jacket and zip-sided trousers. Beneath the leather trousers, he wore an ordinary pair of grey flannels, creased but passable.
He dropped his jack-boots into one of the panniers, from which he had taken a pair of shoes. The leathers went into another pannier, from which came a nondescript tweed jacket and fawn raincoat. When he left the machine and walked into the hotel reception area, he was just an ordinary man in an ordinary Macintosh. Karol Wozniak had not slept well. For one thing, he had been given the shock of his life the previous evening. Normally the air crews of the Polish LOT Airlines, on which he was a senior steward, passed through customs and immigration almost as a formality. This time they had been searched, really searched. When the British officer attending to him had started to rummage through his sponge bag, he had nearly been sick with worry. When the man extracted the electric razor the SB people had given him in Warsaw before takeoff, he had thought he would faint. Fortunately, it was not a battery-operated or rechargeable model. There had been no available electric plug to turn it on. The officer had put it back and completed his search to no avail. Wozniak supposed that if someone had turned the shaver on, it would not have worked. After all, there must be something in it apart from the usual motor. Why else should he be required to bring it to London? At 8, precisely, he entered the public toilets just off the reception area on the ground floor of the post house. A nondescript-looking man in a fawn raincoat was washing his hands. Damn, thought Wozniak. When the contact shows up, we'll have to wait until this Englishman leaves. Then the man spoke to him, in English. Morning. Is that the Yugoslav airline uniform? Wozniak sighed with relief.
No, I am from the Polish National Airline.
Lovely country, Poland, said the stranger, wiping his hands. He seemed completely at ease.
Wozniak was new to this. First and last time, he had sworn to himself. He just stood in the tiled floor, holding his razor.
I've spent many happy times in your country.
That's it, thought Wozniak. Many happy times, the phrase for identification.
He held out the razor. The Englishman scowled and glanced at one of the booth doors. With a start, Wozniak realized the door was closed. There was someone in there. The stranger nodded to the shelf above the wash basins. Wozniak put the razor on it. Then the Englishman nodded towards the urinals. Hastily, Wozniak unzipped his fly and stood in front of one.
Thank you, he burbled. I, too, think it is beautiful.
The man in the fawn coat pocketed the razor, held up five fingers to indicate Wozniak should stay there for 5 minutes, and left. An hour later, Piotrowski and his motorcycle were clearing the suburbs where northeast London borders the county of Essex. The A12 stretched out in front of him. It was 9 o'clock.
At that hour, the Tor Britannia ferry of the DFDS line from Gothenburg was easing herself alongside the Parkstone quay at Harwich, 80 miles away on the Essex coast. The passengers, when they came off, were the usual crowd of tourists, students, and commercial visitors. Among the latter was Mr. Stig Lundqvist, driving his big Saab saloon car. His paper said he was a Swedish businessman, and they did not lie. He was indeed Swedish, and had been all his life. The papers omitted to mention that he was also a long-time communist agent, and worked, like Herr Helmut Dorn, for the redoubtable German Marcus Wolf, the Jewish head of foreign operations of the East German HVA intelligence service. He was, nevertheless, asked to step out of his car and bring his suitcases to the examination bench. This he did with a courteous smile. Another customs officer lifted the engine cover and glanced inside. He was looking for a globe the size of a small football, or a rod-like tube secreted within the compartment. There was nothing like that. He glanced under the frame of the car and finally into the empty boot. He sighed. These demands from London were a pain in the neck. The empty boot contained nothing but the usual toolkit, a wheel jack strapped to one side and the fire extinguisher banded to the other. The Swede stood by his side, his suitcases in his hand.
Please, said the Swede. Is all right?
Yes, thank you, sir. Enjoy your stay.
An hour later, just before 11, the Saab rolled into the car park of the Kingsford Park Hotel in the village of Laer de la Haye, just south of Colchester. Mr. Lundqvist got out and stretched. It was the hour of mid-morning coffee, and there were several cars in the park, all unattended. He glanced at his watch, 5 minutes to rendezvous time. Close, but he knew he would have had the extra hour of waiting time had he been late, then a backup rendezvous somewhere else. He wondered if and when the contact would show. There was no one else around, save for a young man tinkering with the engine of a BMW motorcycle. He had no idea what his contact would look like. He lit a cigarette, got back into his car, and sat there. At 11, there was a tap on the window. The motorcyclist stood outside. Lundqvist pressed the button, and the window hissed down. "Yes?"
"Does the S on your number plate stand for Sweden or Switzerland?" asked the Englishman.
Lundqvist smiled with relief. He had stopped on the road and attached the fire extinguisher, which now reposed in a Hessian bag on the passenger seat.
"It stands for Sweden," he said. "I have just arrived from Gothenburg."
"Never been there," said the man. Then, without a change of inflection, he added, "Got something for me?"
"Yes," said the Swede. "It's in the bag beside me."
"There are windows looking onto the car park," said the motorcyclist. "Drive round the car park, swing past the motorcycle, and drop the bag to me out of the driver's window. Keep the car between me and the windows. 5 minutes from now."
He sauntered back to his machine and went on tinkering. 5 minutes later, the Saab swung past him, and the bag slipped to the ground. He had picked it up and dropped it into his open pannier before the Saab cleared the hotel windows. He never saw the Saab again, nor did he want to. An hour later, he was in his lock-up garage in Thetford, exchanging motorcycle for family saloon and stowing his two cargoes in the car boot. He had no idea what they contained. That was not his job. In the early afternoon, he was home in Ipswich, the two consignments stowed in his bedroom. Couriers 10 and 7 had delivered. John Preston had been due back at work in Gordon Street on the 13th of May.
"I know it's frustrating, but I'd like you to stay on," said Sir Nigel Irvine on one of his visits.
"You'll have to call in with a bad dose of flu. If you need a doctor's chit, let me know. I have a couple who'll oblige." By the 16th, Preston knew he was up a blind alley. Without a major national alert, Customs and Immigration had done all they could. The sheer volume of human traffic prevented the intensive searching of every visitor. It was 5 weeks since the Russian seaman had been mugged in Glasgow, and he was convinced he had missed the rest of the couriers. Perhaps they had all been in the country before Semyonov, and the deckhand had been the last. Perhaps, with growing desperation, he realized he did not know if he had a deadline at all, or if he did, when it was.
On Thursday the 21st of May, the ferry from Ostend berthed at Folkestone and discharged its habitual contents of tourists on foot, others in cars, and the grunting stream of TIR juggernauts that haul the freight of the European Economic Community from one end of Europe to the other. 7 of the huge lorries were of German registration, Ostend being a favoured port on the Britain run of firms operating in North Germany. The big Hanomag articulated rig with its containerised cargo on the trailer behind was no different from all the others. The flat sheaf of paperwork that took an hour to clear was in good order, and there was no reason to believe the driver worked for anyone other than the haulage contractors whose name was printed on the side of his cab. Nor was there any reason to think the rig contained anything other than its prescribed delivery of German coffee machines for the British breakfast table. Behind the cab, 2 big vertical exhaust pipes jutted up towards the sky, carrying the fumes from the diesel engine up and away from other road users. It was already evening. The day shift was drawing to a weary close, and the truck was waved forward on the road to Ashford in London. No one at Folkestone could be expected to know that one of those vertical exhaust tubes, belching dark fumes as it left the customs shed, had a bypass pipe inside it to carry the fumes, or, amid the roar of starting engines, that the sound baffles had been removed to create extra space. Long after dark, on the parking area of a wayside transport cafe near Lenham and Kent, the driver climbed to the top of his cab, unbolted that exhaust pipe, and withdrew from it an 18-inch-long package wrapped in heat-proof cladding. He never opened it. He just handed it to a black-clothed motorcyclist who sped off into the darkness. Courier 8 had delivered.
"It's no good, Sir Nigel," John Preston told the chief of the SIS on the Friday evening. "I don't know what the hell's going on. I fear the worst, but I can't prove it. I've tried to find one other, just one more of those couriers I believe to have come into this country, and I've failed. I think I should go back to Gordon on Monday."
"I know how you feel, John," said Sir Nigel. "I feel much the same. Please give me just one more week."
"I can't see the point," said Preston. "What more can we do?"
"Pray, I suppose," said C gently.
"One break," said Preston angrily. "All I need is just one small break."
Chapter 19. John Preston got his break on the following Monday afternoon. Just after 4, an airliner of Austrian Airlines came into Heathrow from Vienna. One of the travellers aboard, who presented himself at the passport desk for non-UK and non-EEC citizens, offered a perfectly authentic Austrian passport, announcing its bearer to be one Franz Winkler. The immigration officer examined the familiar green plastic-covered reisepass, fronted by the emblematic gold eagle, with the usual apparent indifference of his profession. It was of current issue, dotted with half a dozen other European entry and exit stamps, and had a valid UK visa. Beneath his desk, the officer's left hand tapped out the passport number, perforated through every page of the booklet. He glanced at the display screen, closed the passport, and handed it back with a brief smile. "Thank you, sir. And the next, please." As Herr Winkler picked up his hand grip and moved through, the officer raised his eyes towards a small window facing him 20 feet away. At the same time, his right foot pressed an alert button near the floor. From the office window, one of the resident special branch men caught his gaze. The immigration man looked in the direction of Herr Winkler's back and nodded. The face of the special branch detective withdrew from the window, and seconds later he and a colleague were slipping quietly after the Austrian. Another man was rustling up a car in front of the concourse. Winkler had no heavy luggage, so he ignored the carousels in the baggage hall and went straight through the green channel of customs. In the concourse, he spent some time at the Midland Bank, changing travellers' cheques into sterling currency, during which time one of the SB men got a good picture of him from an upper balcony. When the Austrian took a cab from the rank in front of number 2 building, the SB officers piled into their own unmarked saloon and were right behind him. The driver concentrated on following the taxi. The senior SB detective used the radio to inform Scotland Yard, whence, according to procedure, the information went also to Charles Street. There was a standing order to the effect that 6 was also interested in any visitor carrying a bent passport, so the tip-off was passed by Charles Street to Sentinel House. Winkler took his cab as far as Bayswater and paid it off at the junction of Edgware Road and Sussex Gardens. Then he walked, grip in hand, down Sussex Gardens, one side of which is almost entirely taken up with modest bed-and-breakfast boarding houses of the type favoured by commercial travellers and late arrivals from nearby Paddington Station on modest budgets. He seemed to the special branch officers across the road in their car to have no reservation, for he ambled down the street until he came to a boarding house with a vacancies notice in the window and went in. He must have got a room because he did not emerge. It was 1 hour after Winkler's cab had left Heathrow, and at that time the phone rang in Preston's Chelsea flat. His contact man at Sentinel, the one ordered by Sir Nigel to liaise with Preston, was on the line. "There's a Joe just come in at Heathrow," said the MI6 man. "It may be nothing, but his passport number came up little red lights in the computer. Name of Franz Winkler, Austrian, off the Vienna flight." "They didn't pick him up, I hope," said Preston. He was thinking. Austria is conveniently close to Czechoslovakia and Hungary. Being neutral, it is also a good jump-off point for sub-block illegals. "No," said the man at Sentinel. "According to our standing request, they tailed him. Hold on." He came back on the line a few seconds later. "They've just housed him at a small B&B hotel in Paddington."
"Could you pass me over to see?" asked Preston.
Sir Nigel was in conference, which he left to return to his private office.
"Yes, John."
Preston related the basic facts to the chief of SIS. They had not reached him by then.
Do you think he's the man you've been waiting for?
He could be a courier, said Preston. He's as good as we've had in the past 6 weeks.
So what do you want, John?
I'd like Six to ask for the Watchers to take over. All reports reaching the Watchers' controller at Cork to be monitored by one of your people, as and when they come in. The same to be fed at once to Sentinel and then to me. If he makes a meet, I'd like both men tailed.
All right, said Sir Nigel. I'll ask for the Watchers to take over. Barry Banks will sit in at the Cork radio room and pass the developments down the line as they come in.
The chief personally called up the director of K Branch and made his request. The head of K contacted his colleague at A Branch, and a standby team of Watchers started to head for Sussex Gardens in Paddington. They happened to be led by Harry Birkinshaw. Preston paced his small apartment in a rage of frustration. He wanted to be out on the streets, or at least at the centre of the operation, not tucked away like a deep cover man in his own country, the pawn in a power game being conducted at a level far above his head. By 7 that evening, Harry Birkinshaw's men had moved in, taking over the watch from the special branch men, who happily went off duty. It was a warm and pleasant evening. The four watchers who formed the box took up their unobtrusive stations around the hotel, one up the street, one down, one across, and one in back. The two cars positioned themselves amid scores of others parked along Sussex Gardens, ready to move if Chummy took flight. All six men were in contact via their personal communicator sets, and Birkinshaw with head office, the radio room in the basement at Cork. Barry Banks was in Cork also, since this was an operation requested by Six, and they all waited for Winkler to make contact. The trouble was, he did not. He did nothing. He just sat in his hotel room behind the net curtains and lay low. At 8:30 he came out, walked to a restaurant on Edgware Road, had a simple supper, and went back again. He made no drop, picked up no instruction, left nothing at his tables, spoke to no one in the street. But he did two things of interest. He stopped sharply in Edgware Road on his way to the restaurant, stared in at a plate glass window for several seconds, then headed back the way he had come. It's one of the oldest tricks for trying to spot a tail, and not a very good one. On leaving the restaurant, he paused by the curbside, waited for a gap in the surging traffic, then sprinted across. On the far side, he paused again and scanned the street to see if anyone else had sprinted across after him. No one had. All Winkler had done was join Birkinshaw's fourth watcher, who had been across Edgware Road all the time. While Winkler scanned the traffic to see who might be risking life and limb to pursue him, the watcher was a few feet away, pretending to hail a cab.
"He's bent all right," Birkinshaw told Cork. "He's surveillance-conscious and not very good."
Birkinshaw's judgment reached Preston in his Chelsea hideout. He nodded in relief. It was beginning to look better. After his gyrations on Edgware Road, Winkler returned to his boarding house and spent the rest of the night inside. Meanwhile, another small operation was taking its inspired course in the basement at Sentinel House. The photos of Winkler, taken by special branch men in Heathrow Airport, backed by others taken on the street in Bayswater, had been developed and placed reverentially before the gaze of the legendary Miss Bloodwin. Identification of foreign agents, or foreigners who might possibly be agents, forms a major part of any intelligence organization. To assist in this task, hundreds of thousands of pictures are taken every year by all the agencies of people who may or may not be working for their rivals. Foreign diplomats, members of trade, scientific and cultural delegations, all are photographed as a matter of course, particularly, but not always, if they come from communist or sympathizer countries. The archives grow and grow. The portraits often include 20 shots of the same man or woman, taken at different times and in different places. They are never thrown away. What they are used for is to get a make. If a Russian with the name of Ivanov shows up accompanying a Soviet trade delegation to Canada, his photographed face will almost certainly be passed by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to their colleagues in Washington, London, and the other NATO allies.
It may well be that the same face, calling itself Kozlov, was once snapped 5 years earlier as a visiting journalist at the independence celebrations of an African republic. If there is any question as to Mr. Ivanov's real profession as he takes in the beauties of Ottawa, a make like that will dispel all doubts. It tags him as a full-time KGB hood. The exchange of such photos among the Allied intelligence arms, and they include the brilliant Israeli Mossad, is continuous and comprehensive. Very few sub-bloc visitors to the West, or even the Third World, do not end up gazing from an album of photographs in at least 20 different democratic capitals. No one entering the Soviet Union does not end up in the Center's master gallery of happy snaps. It is the almost hilarious case, but perfectly true, that while Britain's CIA cousins use banks of computers stored with millions and millions of facial features to try to match up the incoming daily flow of photographs, Britain uses Blodwyn. An elderly and often ill-used lady, forever harassed by her younger male colleagues for a quick make, Blodwyn has been in the job 40 years and works underneath Sentinel House, where she presides over the huge archive of pictures that make up MI6's mug book. Not a book at all, it is in fact a cavernous vault where are stored rows and rows of volumes of photographs of which she alone possesses an encyclopedic knowledge. Her mind is something like the CIA's computer bank, which she can occasionally defeat. In it are stored not the tiniest detail of the 30 Years' War, or even the Wall Street stock prices, but faces. Shapes of noses, lines of jaws, casts of eyes, the sag of a cheek, the curve of a lip, the way a glass or a cigarette is held, the glint of a capped tooth showing in a smile taken in an Australian pub and showing up years later in a London supermarket, all are grist to the mill of her remarkable memory. That night, while Bayswater slept and Birkinshaw's men hugged the shadows, Blodwyn sat and stared at the face of Franz Winkler. Two silent younger men from 6 waited. After an hour, she simply said, "Far East," and went off along the rows of her albums. She had her make in the small hours of Tuesday, the 26th of May. It wasn't a good photograph, and it was 5 years old. The hair was darker then, the waist slimmer. He was at a reception at the Indian Embassy, standing beside his own ambassador, smiling deferentially. One of the younger men stared at the two photographs doubtfully. "Are you sure, Blodwyn?" If looks could cripple, he would have needed to invest in a wheelchair. He backed away hastily and made for a telephone. "There's a make," he said. "He's a Czech. 5 years ago he was a low-level gopher in the Czech embassy in Tokyo. Name, Yuri Hayek." Preston was woken by the telephone at 3 in the morning. He listened, thanked the caller, and replaced the phone. He smiled happily. "Gotcha," he said. At 10 in the morning, Winkler was still inside his hotel. Control of the operation at Cork Street had been taken over by Simon Margery from K2B, the Soviet satellite's Czechoslovakia operations desk. After all, a Czech was their affair. Barry Banks, who had slept in the office, was with him, passing developments down the line to Sentinel House. At the same hour, John Preston made a personal call to the legal counsellor at the American Embassy, a personal contact. The legal counsellor at the U.S. Embassy in Grosvenor Square is always the London representative of the FBI. Preston made his request and was told he would be called back as soon as the answer came from America, probably in 5 to 6 hours, bearing in mind the time difference. At 11, Winkler emerged from the boarding house. He walked to Edgware Road again, hailed a cab, and set off towards Park Lane. At Hyde Park Corner, the cab, tailed by 2 cars containing the Watcher team, went down Piccadilly. Winkler dismissed it in Piccadilly, close to the circus end, and tried another few basic manoeuvres to throw off a tail he had not even spotted. "Here we go again," Len Stewart muttered into his lapel. He had read Birkinshaw's log and expected something similar. Winkler shot suddenly down an arcade at a near run, emerged at the other end, scuttled down the pavement, and turned to watch the entrance to the arcade from which he had just emerged. No one came out. They did not need to.
There was already a watcher at the southern end of the arcade. The watchers knew London better than any policeman or cab driver. They know how many exits every major building has, where the arcades and underpasses go, where the narrow passages are located and where they lead to. Wherever a Joe tries to scuttle, there will always be one man there ahead of him, one coming slowly behind, and two flankers. The box never shatters, and it is a very clever Joe who can spot it. Satisfied he had no tail, Winkler entered the British Rail Travel Centre in Lower Regent Street. There he inquired the times of trains to Sheffield. The scarved Scottish football fan, standing a few feet away and trying to get back to Motherwell, was one of the watchers. Winkler paid cash for a second-class return ticket to Sheffield, noted that the last train of the night was out of St. Pancras station at 9:25, thanked the rail clerk, and left. He had lunch in a cafe nearby, returned to Sussex Gardens, and stayed there all afternoon. Preston received the news about the train ticket to Sheffield just after one. He caught Sir Nigel Irvine just as C was about to leave for lunch at his club. "It may be a blind, but it looks as if he's going out of town," he said. "He may be heading for his rendezvous. It could be on the train or in Sheffield. Maybe he's delayed so long because he was early. The point is, sir, if he leaves London, we will need a field controller going with the watcher team. I want to be that controller." "Yeah, see what you mean. Not easy. Still, I'll see what I can do." Sir Nigel sighed. "Bang goes lunch," he thought. He summoned his personal aide. "Cancel my lunch at White's, get my car ready, and take a telegram, in that order." While the aide tackled the first two tasks, Sir Nigel called Sir Bernard Hemmings at his home number near Farnham in Surrey. "Sorry to trouble you, Bernard. Something's cropped up that I'd like your advice on. No, better face to face. Would you mind if I came down? Lovely day, after all. Yes, right, about three, then?" "At the cable," said his aide. "Yes. To whom? Myself." "Certainly. From?" "Head of station, Vienna." "Shall I alert him, sir?" "No need to bother him. Just arrange with Cipher Room for me to receive his cable in 3 minutes." "Of course. And the text?" Sir Nigel dictated it. Sending himself an urgent message to justify what he wanted to do anyway was an old trick that he had picked up from his one-time mentor, the late Sir Maurice Oldfield. When the Cipher Room sent it back up in the form it would have been received from Vienna, the old mandarin put it in his pocket and went down to his car. He found Sir Bernard in his garden at Tilford, enjoying the warm May sunshine, a blanket round his knees.
"Meant to come in today," said the Director General of Five, with well-feigned joviality. "Be in tomorrow, no doubt."
"Of course, of course.
Now, how can I help?"
"Ticklish," said Sir Nigel. "Someone has just flown into London from Vienna, apparent Austrian businessman, but he's a phony. We got a make on him last night. Check agent, one of the STB boys, low level. We think he's a courier." Sir Bernard nodded.
"Yes, I keep in touch, even from here. Heard all about it. My chaps are on top of him, aren't they?"
"Very much so. The thing is, it looks as if he may be leaving London tonight for the north. Five will need a field controller to go with the watcher team."
"Of course. We'll have one. Brian can handle it."
"Yes, it's your operation, of course. Still, you remember the Berenson affair? We never did discover two things. Does Moray communicate through the Residentura here in London, or does he use couriers sent in from outside?
And was Berenson the only man in the ring run by Moray, or were there others?" "I recall. We were going to put those questions on ice until we could get a few answers out of Moray."
"That's right. Then today I got this cable from my head of station in Vienna."
He proffered the cable. Sir Bernard read it, and his eyebrows rose.
"Linked, could they be?" "Possible. Winkler, a.k.a. Hayek, seems to be a courier of some kind. Vienna confirms he's nominally STB, but actually working for the KGB itself. We know Moray was twice in Vienna in the past 2 years, while he was running Berenson, each time on cultural jaunts, but..."
"The missing link."
Sir Nigel shrugged. "Never oversell."
"So what's he going to Sheffield for?"
"Who knows, Bernard? Is there another ring up there in Yorkshire?
Could Winkler be a bagman for more than one ring?
So what do you want from five? More watchers?
No, John Preston. You'll recall he tracked down Berenson first, then Marais. I liked his style. He's been on leave for a while. Then he had a dose of flu, so they tell me. But he's due to return to work tomorrow. He's been off so long, he'll probably have no current cases anyway. Technically, he's ports and airports, C5C, but you know how the K-boys are always worked off the feet. If he could just have a temporary attachment to K2B, you could designate him field controller for this one. Well, I don't know, Nigel. This is really down to Brian. I'd be awfully grateful, Bernard. Let's face it, Preston was on the Berenson hunt right from the start. If Winkler is part of it all, he might even see a face he's seen before.
All right, said Sir Bernard. You've got it. I'll issue the instruction from here.
I could take it back if you like, said C, to save you the trouble. Send my driver up to Charles Street with a chit. He left Tilford with his chit. A written order from Sir Bernard Hemmings putting John Preston on temporary attachment to K Branch and naming him field controller of the Winkler operation once it left the metropolis. Sir Nigel had two copies made, one for himself and one for John Preston. The original went to Charles Street. Brian Harcourt Smith was out of the office, so the order was left on his desk. At 7 that evening, John Preston left the Chelsea apartment for the last time. He was out in the open again, and loved it. At Sussex Gardens, he slipped up behind Harry Birkinshaw.
Hello, Harry. Good Lord, John Preston. What are you doing here?
Taking a breath of air.
Well, don't make yourself visible. We've got a juror holed up there across the road.
I know. I gather he's due to leave for Sheffield on the 9:25.
How did you know that?
Preston produced his copy of Sir Bernard's instruction. Birkinshaw studied it.
Well, from the DG himself. Join the party, then. Just stay out of sight.
I've got a spare lapel set. Birkinshaw nodded down the road. Around the corner in Radnor Place, Brown Cortina. There's a spare in the glove compartment. I'll wait in the car, said Preston. Birkinshaw was puzzled. No one had told him about Preston joining them as field controller. He did not even know Preston was in check section. Still, the DG's signature carried a lot of weight. For his part, he would just get on with his job. He shrugged, popped another mint, and went on watching.
At 8:30, Winkler left the hotel. He was carrying his grip.
He hailed a passing cab and gave his instructions to the driver. As he stepped out of the doorway, Birkinshaw called in his team and his two cars. He jumped in the first one, and they were 100 yards behind the cab across Edgware Road. Preston was in the second car. 10 minutes later, they knew they were heading east towards the station. Birkinshaw reported this. Simon Marjorie's voice came back from Cork.
"Okay, Harry, our field controller is on his way."
"We've got a field controller," said Birkinshaw. "He's with us." This was news to Marjorie. He asked the controller's name. When he heard it, he thought there had been a mistake.
"He's not even with K2B," he protested.
"He is now," said Birkinshaw, unfazed. "I've seen the chit, signed by the DG." Marjorie from Cork Street called up Charles. As the cavalcade cruised east through the dusk, a flap ensued at Charles Street. The instruction from Sir Bernard was traced and confirmed. Marjorie threw up his hands in exasperation.
"Why can't the buggers up there in Charles ever make up their minds?" he asked, an uncaring world.
He called off the colleague he had designated to take over at St. Pancras Station. Then he tried to trace Brian Harcourt Smith to complain. Winkler paid off his cab on the forecourt of the station, headed through the single brick archway into the vaulted dome of the Victorian railway station, and consulted the departure board. Around him, the four watchers and Preston vaporized into the throng of passengers in the brick and cast-iron concourse. The 9:25 was on Platform 2, calling at Leicester, Derby, Chesterfield, and Sheffield. Having found his train, Winkler walked up the length of it, past the three first-class carriages, the buffet car, to the three blue-upholstered second-class carriages near the front end. He selected the middle one, hefted his grip onto the rack, and sat quietly awaiting the departure.
It was an open-plan carriage, and after a few minutes a young black man with earphones over his head and a Walkman music player clipped onto his belt came in and sat three rows away. Once seated, the man nodded his head in time to the apparent reggae blasting into his ears, closed his eyes, and enjoyed his music. One of Birkinshaw's team was in place. The earphones were silent of reggae music, but were picking up Harry's instructions on strength 5. One of Birkinshaw's team took the front carriage, Harry and John Preston the third, so that Winkler was boxed, and the fourth man took a first-class seat at the rear, in case Winkler did a runner down the train to shake off what he thought was a tail. At 9:25 on the dot, the Intercity 125 hissed out of St. Pancras and headed north. At 9:30, Brian Harcourt-Smith was traced to the dining room of his club and called to the phone. It was Simon Marjorie. What he heard caused the deputy DG of 5 to hasten outside, grab a taxi, and race the 2 miles across the West End Charles Street. On his desk he found the order written out earlier that afternoon by Sir Bernard Hemmings. He went quite pale with rage. He was a highly self-disciplined man, and after thinking the matter over for several minutes, he picked up the phone and asked the operator, in his usual courteous manner, to get in the service's legal adviser at his home. The legal adviser is the man who does most of the liaison between the service and the special branch. While the call was coming through, he checked train times to Sheffield. The legal adviser was plucked from his seat in front of the television in Camberley and came on the line. "I need special branch to make an arrest," said Harcourt-Smith. "I have reason to believe an illegal immigrant suspected of being a Soviet agent may escape surveillance. Name Franz Winkler, supposed Austrian citizen. Holding charge, suspected false passport. He'll be arriving by train from London at Sheffield at 11:59. Yes, I know it's short notice, that's why it's urgent. Yes, please get on to the commander's special branch at the yard and ask him to jack up his Sheffield operation to make the arrest when the train arrives at Sheffield." He put the phone down grimly. John Preston might have been sicked on him as field director of the surveillance team, but an arrest of a suspect was a policy matter, and that was his department. The train was almost empty. 2 carriages instead of 6 would have amply accommodated the 60 passengers on board. Barney, the watcher in the front carriage, shared the space with 10 others, all innocent passengers. He was facing aft, so that he could see the top of Winkler's head through the intercarriage door glass. Ginger, the young black with the headphones, who was with Winkler in the second carriage, had 5 others in there with him. There were 12 sharing 60 seats with Preston and Birkinshaw in the third. For 1.25 hours, Winkler did nothing. He had no reading matter. He just stared out of the window at the dark countryside beyond. At 10:45 the train slowed down for Leicester, and he moved. He took his grip off the rack, walked up the carriageway, passed out to the toilet area, and pulled down the window of the door giving onto the platform. Ginger informed the rest, who prepared to move at short notice if they had to. Another passenger pushed past Winkler as the train stopped. "Excuse, please, is this Sheffield?" Winkler asked. "No, it's Leicester," the man said, and descended to the platform. "Ah, so. Thank you," said Winkler. He put down his grip, but stayed at the open window, looking up and down the platform during the brief stopover. As the train pulled out, he returned to his seat and put his grip back on the rack. At 11:12 he did it again at Derby. This time he asked a porter on the platform of the cavernous concrete hall that forms Derby Station. "Derby," sang out the porter, "Sheffield is the one after next." Again, Winkler spent the stopover gazing out of the open window, then returned to his seat and tossed his grip onto the rack. Preston was watching him through the intercarriage doors. At 11:43 they rolled into Chesterfield, a Victorian station but beautifully maintained with bright paintwork and hanging baskets of flowers. This time Winkler left his grip where it was, but went to lean out of the window as 2 or 3 passengers quit the train and hurried through the ticket barrier. The platform was empty before the train began to roll. When it did, Winkler snapped open the door, jumped to the moving concrete, and slammed the door closed with a backward movement of one arm.
Birkinshaw was very rarely caught off balance by a Joe, but he later admitted Winkler had got him cold. All four of the watchers could easily have made the platform, but there was not an iota of cover on that strip of stone, and they would have been about as unobtrusive as a sow in a synagogue. Winkler must have seen them and aborted his rendezvous, wherever it was. Preston and Birkinshaw ran forward to the boarding platform, where they were joined by Ginger from the carriage in front. The window was still open. Preston stuck his head out and looked back. Winkler, satisfied at last that he had no tail, was striding briskly down the platform with his back to the train.
"Harry, get back here with the team by car," shouted Preston. "Get me on the radio when you're in range. Ginger, close the door after me."
He shoved the door open, stepped to the running board, dropped into the paratrooper's land position, and jumped. Paratroopers hit the deck at about 11 miles per hour. Sideways speed depends on the wind. The train was doing 30 when Preston slammed into the embankment, praying he would not hit a concrete post or large stone. He was lucky. The thick May grass took some of the shock. Then he was rolling, knees together, elbows in, head down. Harry told him later he couldn't watch. Ginger said he was bouncing like a toy along the embankment and finally towards the spinning wheels. When he finally stopped, he was lying in the gully between the grass and the permanent way. He hauled himself to his feet, turned, and began to jog back towards the lights of the station. When he appeared at the ticket barrier, the guard was closing for the night. He looked at the grazed apparition in the torn coat with amazement.
"The last man through here," said Preston. "Short, stocky, grey Macintosh. Where did he go?"
The guard nodded towards the forecourt, and Preston ran. Too late, the guard realized he had not collected the ticket. In the forecourt, Preston saw the taillights of a taxi sweeping out of the yard and towards the town. It was the last taxi. He could, he knew, get the local police to trace the taxi driver and ask where he took that client, but he had no doubt Winkler would dismiss the taxi short of his ultimate destination and walk the rest. A few feet away, a railway porter was kick-starting his moped.
"I need to borrow your bike," said Preston.
"Bug off," said the porter. There was no time for identification or argument. The lights of the taxi were passing under the new ring road and out of sight, so Preston hit him just once on the jaw. The porter crashed over. Preston caught the falling moped, jerked it free of the man's legs, straddled it, and rode off. He was lucky with the traffic lights. The taxi had gone up Corporation Street, and Preston would never have caught it on his tiny-engined putt-putt, except that the lights outside the Central Library were at red. When the taxi rolled down Helliwell Street and into Saltergate, he was 100 yards behind, and then he lost more ground as the bigger engine outpaced him for the straight half-mile of that highway. If Winkler had been taken out into the countryside due west of Chesterfield, Preston could never have caught him. Fortunately, the taxi's brake lights flashed on when it was a speck in the distance. Winkler was paying it off, where Saltergate becomes Ashgate Road. As Preston closed the gap, he could see Winkler beside the car, looking up and down. There was no other traffic, nothing for it but to keep going. He puttered past the halted taxi like a late homegoer about his business, swerved into Foljam Road, and stopped. Winkler crossed the top of the road on foot. Preston followed. Winkler never looked back again. He just strolled round the boundary wall of Chesterfield Football Ground and into Compton Street. Here he approached a house and knocked on the door. Moving between patches of shadow, Preston had reached the corner of the street and was hidden behind a bush in the garden of the corner house. Up the street, he saw lights come on in a darkened house, and the door opened. There was a brief conversation on the doorstep, and Winkler went inside. Preston sighed and settled behind his bush for a night-long vigil. He could not read the number of the house Winkler had entered, nor could he watch the rear of the place as well, but he could see the towering wall of the football ground behind the house, so perhaps there was no feasible exit on that side. At 2 in the morning, he heard the faint noise on his communicator as Birkinshaw came back into range. He identified himself and gave his position. At 2:30, he heard the soft pad of footsteps and hissed to give his location. Birkinshaw joined him in the shrubbery.
"You all right, John?"
"Yes. He's housed up there, second beyond the tree with the light behind the curtain."
"Got it. John? There was a reception party at Sheffield. 2 special branch and 3 uniformed. Drummed up by London. Did you want an arrest?"
"Absolutely not. Winkler's a courier.
I want the big fish. He might be inside that house. What happened to the Sheffield party?
Birkinshaw laughed.
Thank God for the British police. Sheffield is Yorkshire. This is Derbyshire. They're going to have to sort it out between the chief constables in the morning. It gives you time.
Yeah. Where are the others?
Down the street. They came back by taxi and dismissed it. John, we've got no wheels. Also, come the dawn, the street's got no cover.
Put two at the top end and two down here, said Preston. I'm going back into the town centre to find the police station and ask for a bit of backup. If Chummy leaves, tell me. But shadow him with two of the team. Keep two on that house.
He left the garden and walked back into central Chesterfield, looking for the police station, which he found in Beatwell Street. As he walked, a phrase kept repeating itself in his head. There was something about Finkler's performance that did not make sense.
Chapter 20. Superintendent Robin King was not pleased to be woken at 3 in the morning, but on hearing there was an officer of MI5 from London at his police station seeking assistance, he agreed to come at once, and was there, unshaven and uncombed, 20 minutes later. He listened attentively while Preston explained the gist of the story, that a foreigner believed to be a Soviet agent had been tailed from London, had jumped train at Chesterfield, and been followed to a house in Compton Street, number as yet unknown. I do not yet know who lives in that house or why our suspect has visited it. I intend to find out, but for the moment I do not want an arrest. I want to watch the house. Later this morning we can sort out a fuller authority through the Chief Constable for Derbyshire. For the moment the problem is more urgent. I have 4 men of our watcher service in that street, but come the daylight they'll stick out like sore thumbs, so I need some assistance now. And what exactly can I do for you, Mr. Preston? The senior police officer asked. Have you got an unmarked van, for instance?
No, several police cars, unmarked, and a couple of vans, but with police insignia on the side.
Can we get hold of an unmarked van and park it in that street with my men inside, just as a temporary measure?
The superintendent called the duty sergeant on the phone. He put the same question and listened for a while.
Raise him on the phone and ask him to call me right now, he said.
To Preston, one of our men is a van. It's pretty battered. He's always having his leg pulled about it.
30 minutes later, the sleepy police constable had made his rendezvous with the watcher team outside the football stadium main entrance. Birkinshaw and his men piled inside, and the van was driven into Compton Street and parked opposite the suspect house. On instructions, the policeman climbed out, stretched, and walked away down the road, for all the world like a man coming home from night shift. From the rear windows, Birkinshaw peered out and came on the radio to Preston.
"That's better," he said. "I've got a great view of the house across the road. By the way, it's number 59.
"Hold on there for a while," said Preston. "I'm trying to fix something better. Meanwhile, if Winkler leaves on foot, tail him with 2 men and leave 2 to stay with the house. If he leaves by car, follow in the van. Superintendent, we may have to stake out that house for a longer period. That means taking over the front upper room of a house across the road. Can we find anyone in Compton Street who might let us do that?"
The police chief was thoughtful.
"I do know someone who lives in Compton Street," he said.
"We're both Masons, members of the same lodge. That's how I know him.
A former chief petty officer in the Navy, retired now. He's at number 68. I don't know where it is in the street, though."
Birkinshaw confirmed that 68 was across the road and 2 houses up. The upper front window, almost certainly the main bedroom, would give perfect observation of the target. Superintendent King rang his friend from the station. At Preston's suggestion, he told the sleepy householder, Mr. Sam Royston, that this was a police operation. They wished to watch a possible suspect who had taken refuge across the road. When he had gathered his wits, Mr. Royston rose to the occasion. As a law-abiding citizen, he would certainly allow the police to use his front room.
The van was quietly driven round the block into West Street. Birkinshaw and his team slipped between the houses there, over the garden fences, and entered Mr. Royston's house on Compton Street from the back garden. Just before the summer sun flooded the road, the watcher team settled down in the Royston's unmade-up bedroom behind the lace curtains, through which they could see number 59 across the street. Mr. Royston, ramrod stiff in camel dressing gown and bristling with the self-importance of a patriot asked to assist the Queen's officers, glowered through the curtains of the house almost opposite.
Bank robbers, are they? Drug traffickers?
Something like that, assented Birkinshaw.
Foreigners, growled Royston. Never did like him. Should never have let them all into the country.
Ginger, whose parents had come from Jamaica, stared solidly through the curtains. Mungo, the Scot, was bringing a pair of chairs up from below. Mrs. Royston emerged like a mouse from some secret hiding place, having removed her curlers and pins.
Would anyone, she inquired, like a nice cup of tea?
Barney, who was young and handsome, flashed his most winning smile. That would be lovely, ma'am. It made her day. She began to prepare the first of what turned out to be an endless relay of cups of tea, a brew upon which she appeared to live without any visible recourse to solid foods. At the police station, the desk sergeant had also established the identity of the inhabitants of 59 Compton Street.
Two Greek Cypriots, sir, he reported to Superintendent King, both bachelors and brothers. Andreas and Spyridon Stephanides. Been here about 4 years, according to the constable in that beat. Seems they run a doner kebab and Greek takeaway at Holywell Cross.
Preston had spent half an hour on the phone to London. First he raised the duty officer at Sentinel, who put him through to Barry Banks. Barry, I want you to contact C, wherever he is, and ask him to call me back. Sir Nigel Irvin came on the line 5 minutes later, calm and lucid, as if he had not been asleep at all. Preston informed him of the night's events.
Sir, there was a reception party at Sheffield. Two SBs and three uniformed, authorised to make an arrest.
I don't think that was part of the arrangement, John.
Not as far as I was concerned. All right, John, I'll handle it at this end. You've got the house. Are you going to move in now?
I've got a house, corrected Preston.
I don't want to move in because I don't think it's the end of the trail.
One other thing, sir. If Winkler leaves and heads for home, I want him to be allowed to go in peace. If he is a courier, or message carrier, or just checking up, his people will be expecting him back in Vienna. If he fails to show, they'll switch off the cutouts from top to bottom.
Yes, said Sir Nigel carefully. I'll have a word with Sir Bernard about that. Do you want to stay with the operation up there, or come back to London?
I'd like to stay up here, if possible.
All right, I'll make it a top-level request from six that what you want is accorded to you. Now, cover your back and make your operational report to Charles Street.
When he put the phone down, Sir Nigel called Sir Bernard Hemmings at his home. The Director-General of Five agreed to meet him for breakfast at the Cavalry and Guards Club at eight.
So you see, Bernard, it really may be the Centre is mounting quite a large operation inside this country at the moment,
said C, as he buttered his second piece of toast. Sir Bernard Hemmings was deeply disturbed. He sat with his food untouched in front of him.
"Brian should have told me about the Glasgow incident," he said. "What the hell's that report still sitting on his desk for?"
"We all make errors of judgment from time to time. Errare humanum est and all that," murmured Sir Nigel. "After all, my Vienna people thought Winkler was a bagman for a long-standing ring of agents, and I deduced Jan Marais might be one of that ring. Now it appears there could be two separate operations after all."
He refrained from admitting he himself had written the Vienna telegram of the previous day in order to obtain what he wanted from his colleague, Preston's inclusion as field controller in the Winkler operation. For C, there was a time for candour and a time for discreet silence.
"And the second operation, the one linked to the intercept in Glasgow?" asked Sir Bernard.
Sir Nigel shrugged.
"I just don't know, Bernard. We're all feeling our way in the dark. Brian evidently does not believe it. He may be right, in which case I'm the one with egg all over his face. And yet the Glasgow affair, the mysterious transmitter in the Midlands, the arrival of Winkler. That man Winkler was a lucky break, maybe the last we'll get."
"Then what are your conclusions, Nigel?"
Sir Nigel smiled apologetically. It was the question he had been waiting for.
"No conclusions, Bernard. A few tentative deductions. If Winkler is a courier,
I'd expect him to make his contact and hand over his package, or pick up the package he came to collect, at some public place, a car park, river embankment, garden bench, seat by a pond. If there is a big operation going on here, there must be a top-level illegal in on the ground, the man running the show. If you were him, would you want the couriers turning up at your doorstep? Of course not. You'd have a cutout, maybe two. Do have some coffee.
All right, agreed, Sir Bernard waited, as his colleague poured him a cup.
Therefore, Bernard, it occurs to me that Winkler cannot be the big fish. He's small potatoes, a bagman, a courier, or something else.
Same goes for the two Cypriots in a small house in Chesterfield. Sleepers, wouldn't you say?
Yes, agreed Sir Bernard. Low-level sleepers. It begins to look, therefore, as if the Chesterfield house might be a depository for incoming packages, a mailbox, a safe house, or maybe the home of the transmitter. After all, it's in the right area. The two squirts intercepted by GCHQ were from the Derbyshire Peak District and the hills north of Sheffield, an easy drive from Chesterfield.